The Roswell UFO incident was the apparent recovery of extraterrestrial debris, including alien corpses, from an object which crashed near Roswell, New Mexico in July of 1947.
Headline edition, July 8, 1947. The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army. Army officers say the missile, found sometime last week, has been inspected at Roswell, New Mexico, and sent to Wright Field, Ohio, for further inspection.
Well, since the late 1970s, the incident has been the subject of intense controversy and the subject of theories as to the true nature of the object which crashed. The United States military maintains that what was actually recovered was debris from an experimental high-altitude surveillance balloon belonging to a classified program called Mogul. However, many UFO proponents maintain that, in fact, a crashed alien craft and bodies were recovered and that the military then engaged in a cover-up. In a moment, we will be talking with Tom Carey and Don Schmidt, and then later on, a witness to Roswell. On Coast to Coast AM. And later on tonight, we'll be talking to the last surviving member of the B-29 crew that flew the apparent alien bodies out of the Roswell Army Airfield back in 1947. Two guests now, Tom Carey, Don Schmidt. Tom, of course, has been a Mutual UFO State Section Director in southeastern Pennsylvania, a special investigator for the J. Allen Hynek for UFO Studies, and a member of the CUFOs Board of Directors. Tom began investigating the Roswell incident in 1999 for the Roswell investigative team of Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt, whom I'll introduce in a moment, and since 1998 has teamed exclusively with Don to pursue a proactive investigation. Here's Tom Carey back on Coast to Coast. Tom, how are you?
How are you, George?
Good. I'm looking forward to this tonight.
Just one small correction. I've been investigating the Roswell case since 1991.
Okay.
I think you said 1999. So it's 1991. It'll be 19 years this month.
You got it. Okay. And Don Schmidt, former co-director of the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies. He served as a director of special investigations for 10 years. And prior to that, he was the special investigator for the late Dr. J. Allen Hynek, also for the International UFO Reporter. And here is Don Schmidt back on Coast to Coast. Hey, Don.
Hey, George. So good to be back with you again.
Likewise. We'll bring in a very special witness in about 15 minutes or so, and I'll have you two tell us a little bit about him.
But, we'll have to wake him up, right?
Yeah, we'll get there. Late hours for people, huh? Hey, let's go back. Let's review, both of you. How did you both become interested in UFOs in general, Roswell specifically? Tom?
Well, George, like a lot of UFO, people interested in UFOs, I got interested when I was a kid. My older brother had read things such as newspapers, which I didn't.
They're not doing that now either.
Right. And he said, hey, Tom, listen to this. And he would describe an incident that would appear in the local newspaper. And it just caught my fancy. I can't explain why, but I just thought it was something really unusual and interesting. And that interest really never faded. I read my first book, I think it was the Ruppelt book in 1956.
Report on unidentified flying objects.
Yeah, report on unidentified flying objects, and that really made it take off for me. And as far as the crashed UFOs, I guess, you know, you get tired, at least I do. I'm sure the people who see the various things in the sky don't feel that way. But for me, the lights in the sky phenomenon just doesn't do it for me.
I know. And I understand. You want something else. You want something more concrete.
Yeah, I'm a nuts and bolts type of guy. Yeah. I have a straight line thinking. When people start talking about, well, maybe they're from our future or, you know, something like that, about my eyes glaze over. I'm sort of a straight ahead type of guy. And in 1980, I read the Roswell incident book, which was the first one on the on the case. And I said, wow, this, you know, this is just tremendous. Talking about actual nuts and bolts artifacts, and not only that, but alien cadavers as well. And ever since then, it's been the Roswell case for me.
Yeah, I'm like you, Tom. You know, when I get these calls and cases, I want to see these craft land. I want to see somebody who says, I saw bolts and rivets in the thing.
Yes.
You know, you want to see that.
Yes.
And,
exactly.
You know, a light that zooms by is, you know, that's not going to do much for you.
Right. Well, take the Stevensville sightings, what, 2 years ago?
Yeah, down in Texas.
Very good sightings, but it's sort of nowhere now. It's just a very good sighting. I still don't think they've explained it, but it doesn't move the phenomenon forward any.
How about you, Don Schmidt? How'd you get interested in studying UFOs and investigating?
Well, I can't imagine not being interested in it. Talking the biggest story of the millennium in any one of these reports, all it takes is one to be true, and we solve it overnight. But I came into it very skeptical. In fact, even working with Dr. Hynek was quite the agnostic. We used to explain cases that even left him puzzled at times, and he was always quick to bounce opinions off of us, and we always had the alternative explanations. And it was certainly the case with Roswell. In fact, as Tom described, having even read the first book, Roswell Incident, I had not. I just could not accept that something of this magnitude could be kept a secret after all that time. And even our first trip down to New Mexico in the beginning of 1989, we thought we'd, you know, simply wrap this up in a weekend. You know, we'd come away with it being a weather balloon or something just as conventional. But then we started to talk to the first 10 witnesses, and testimony that would suffice in any court of law would be accepted as far as just by the sincerity, the credibility of the witnesses involved. And we came away, you know, with this position that we better quickly come up to speed, because what if we're wrong? And so here it is, 9 years after the book came out, and I'm first reading Roswell Incident, as Kevin Randall at that time as well. And we had to admit we were wrong. And here now over 100 trips, you know, more to New Mexico and practically to every state across the country, tracking down these eyewitnesses. And then hence, you know, even the title of our current book, Witness to Roswell. You know, we're speaking for these people. We're, you know, serving as spokespeople for people no longer with us, most now passed on.
Oh, sure. There's only less than a handful, I think.
Handful, but we are still hot on the trail, because we realize we're on the 5-yard line, so to speak.
What happens when these witnesses have passed on, and if we haven't truly uncovered the story to the point where government will admit it? Do we lose it, or can we still pound away at it?
We, I've thought about this, George. We've mostly right now we're speaking to the surviving relatives of the actual witnesses, and they are, you know, oftentimes where the principal witness, if they were still alive, would not talk to us. The surviving relatives will. So that's a little bonus to consider. Yes, they are passing on, and I would say right now there's no more than 5% perhaps still alive. The principal witness, Mac Brazel, died in 1963.
Yeah,
that's a long time ago. And I've told Don often that we see the case passing before our eyes, but we have to stay on it, because it's too important. It's the best case we have, and for me, and certainly for Don, it's the most interesting case ever, and that's what really holds our interest, is that the case has everything. But we were not going to let this go until A, we pass on, B, we find a piece of absolute incontrovertible physical evidence, or C, I forget what C is.
But government admits.
The government would confess. The government would fess up.
Right, which they're never going to do.
No, I don't think so either. I've gotten into friendly arguments with Stephen Bassett about disclosure.
As we have.
And I just don't think government's going to come out and say it. They're just not.
One of the reasons, and Don and I have talked about this, is one of the reasons they're not going to come forward on the UFO phenomenon is because they don't want to have to answer questions about what they did at Roswell. They committed crimes at Roswell to cover it up. They are never going to admit that, and for that reason, they are not even going to come clean on the total phenomenon because they don't want to answer about Roswell.
Didn't they threaten witnesses?
Well, precisely, the culpability, and it's something we've even talked to Stan Friedman about, which he agrees, that there would be hell to pay. And I mean, violations even against the Constitution, the fact that the government used the military to actually threaten, and possibly worse, its own citizenry. And even down to children, as you've heard the stories, George, the fact that were told, you will never see your parents again. Again, over a simple weather balloon device, an upper atmospheric surveillance device, as Mogul was. And here it is now 63 years later. And these people still feel intimidated. They still question as far as the loss of their pensions and the very protection of their loved ones regarding this. They still have this deep, dark secret, this sinister element to this whole case. And to us, it also makes the ultimate cold case file, the idea that there were crimes committed. There were people's rights violated. And as one officer suggested to us around that time regarding some of the accidents reported in the local press, he kind of joked that they weren't all accidents.
The mortician, Glenn Dennis, he's getting way up there in age now, isn't he?
Yes, he's very frail. I believe he no longer comes to the museum. He's one of the founders, one of the three founders with Walter Hout and Max Littell. Both Walter and Max are gone, and Glenn is very frail. And
I think I met him at the 60th anniversary of Roswell, and that was several years ago.
Yeah, yes. He still would have been up and about at that time. He's in a full care facility. We had hoped to even visit with him this past December and most likely to even say goodbye after all the years. And our association with Glenn goes back to 1990.
Tell us this incredible story of Glenn Dennis, the mortician. What happened to him? What did they ask him to do? What did he see?
Well, Glenn, his story is that he started receiving phone calls. He was an embalmer, mortician embalmer, mm-hmm. at the Ballard Funeral Home in 1947. I believe he was around 22 years old at the time. Started receiving phone calls from the airbase south of town about how to treat animals or living tissue that had been living that was out in the desert for several days, and also if they had any child-sized caskets. And Glenn said that, well, they had one in stock, but they could get more from Amarillo, et cetera, et cetera. So he kept receiving these calls throughout the day from the airbase about how to treat beings that had, or someone who had been dead lying out in the desert. And he finally said, have you had aircraft accident? I'll get my stuff and I'll be right over. And they said, oh, no, this is just for future reference.
Yeah, they didn't want him to see anything, did they?
They did not want him to see anything. Well, to cut to the chase, the Ballard Funeral Home also had the ambulance contract with the airbase. The hearse doubled as an ambulance. So I don't know. I would want to be taken to the hospital in a hearse. That would not be a good
omen.
good thing. No. Anyway, Glenn took an airman, an injured airman, to the base hospital the day that the impact site north of town was found. This would be July 7, 1947. And he noticed that the hospital area was buzzing with people he did not recognize, medical people. And so he goes in there and drops the injured airman off, and he runs into a nurse friend of his who says, Glenn, you better get out of here. She's coming out of a side room with a towel over her face because she's coughing and wheezing. And she says, you better get out of here. You're going to get into trouble. And just then someone says, hey, you, who are you? And he says, well, I'm the mortician, blah, blah, blah. And they say, well, you better get out of here. This is the famous red-haired captain. Who I think we found, Don can address that. But so they escorted Glenn Dennis out of there in a rough manner and told him to get back to the Ballard Funeral Home, and they followed him all the way back. And all this time, Glenn is saying, you can't do this to me. I'm a civilian. You cannot do this to me. And they say, well, we'll show you what we can do to you. And they just physically removed him from the hospital and sent him back to town.
And this nurse was distraught, wasn't she?
The nurse was distraught. She was just beside herself. And the next day, they met in the officers' club. And Glenn wanted to find out what was going on. And she said that there had been an attempted autopsy of alien bodies that had crashed north of town in a UFO. Like they called them flying saucers back then. And she was still distraught. She didn't touch her food. And she drew for Glenn a picture of what they looked like on a prescription pad. And, you know, the classic, you know, large head.
The grays, right?
Yeah, the classic grays. And so she drew that. And she says, I got to leave now. I'm sick. Well, Glenn never saw her again. He kept contacting the where the nurses stayed. And he was finally told that she had been transferred.
Well, we really don't know, do we?
No. Now, that's his story. His story has come under,
scrutiny.
Scrutiny. I was trying to intense scrutiny by skeptics. And he gave us a name for the nurse of this Naomi Maria Self.
You were never able to find her.
We were never able to find her. A lot of capital was expended in trying to locate her. And finally, someone went to Glenn, we cannot locate this Naomi Maria Self. There's no record that she was ever a nurse in the Army or Air Force or military or anybody by that name. He says, well, they gave you the phony name. They gave you a phony name.
Why did he do that?
Well, the story he gave to us, and we've quizzed him often on this, is that he promised her that he would never reveal her name. That's the story he gave her, that he gave us, that he promised her. We don't buy it. We never, well, maybe at one time we did, but after the investigation, we don't buy that. Don can fill you in on what we found regarding the nurse, because we do believe we have found her.
Okay, let's talk about that. And also, we're going to be bringing in Arthur Osipchuk. How old is he now?
He is 86.
86 years old. He's the last surviving member of that flight, right?
Yes, there was a B-29 flight. There were two flights flying out the bodies.
Okay, we're gonna come right back. We're going to have you, both of you, set the stage for Arthur, and then we'll have him for just a half hour. And then we'll get back with Tom and Don as well throughout the night here on Coast to Coast AM. Up next, we're going to be talking with one of those witnesses who flew the B-29, the plane from Roswell to Wright-Patterson to wherever it may have gone. We'll find out in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Tom Carey and Don Schmidt. Next hour, we'll pick up on that nurse story that we were talking about, who came out of the hospital and talked to the mortician, Glenn Dennis, about what he saw. Tom and Don, we've got Arthur on the line, and before we bring him in, let's have you explain to us who he is and what happened.
Well, the important point we need to emphasize is that what Arthur's ready to describe happened the day after the famous weather balloon press conference at Fort Worth. This was the afternoon, whereas that very morning, all the banner headlines explaining this all away is nothing more than a weather balloon. So everything had quieted down. Everything had returned to normal. General Ramey essentially chastised, you know, those idiots over at Roswell, albeit in charge of the atomic bomb, they couldn't tell the difference between a weather balloon and something truly.
And he had all those things spread out all over the place, right?
In his office, in front of his desk, correct. Yeah. Clearly a weather balloon device as displayed to the press. But the witnesses say otherwise. Now, it would be the very next afternoon, about 3 in the afternoon, and it was a flight crew. They were on the Skeet Range, and they were notified that there was a special flight, that they needed to be briefed and conduct a pre-flight on to go out within an hour. And once that was accomplished, there was a B-29, specifically tail number 7301, and we know that because one of the crewmen actually saved the manifest, the flight log, from that non-flight. And the plane was called the Straight Flush. And they would taxi over bomb pit number one, where typically they would keep one of the atomic bombs. Mm. And the pit itself was only visible from the air traffic tower and, you know, some areas of the flight line. But waiting as they approached was a sealed, unmarked, rectangular wooden crate, and it was under heavy guard. In fact, there were 6 guards, and they would taxi over the pit. The crate would be loaded into the bomb bay. The guards would accompany the crate, and from there they would fly and make a one-hour flight directly to Fort Worth, the very same military base, Carswell Army Airfield, that they had the weather balloon press conference just the day before. And it was a bombardier on that flight by the name of Felix Martucci. When they landed, he recognized amongst the officers waiting on the tarmac a mortician that he had gone to school with years before. Now, why would a mortician be waiting for this rectangular crate, which was hidden in bomb pit number one? Now, Arthur was a tech sergeant at that time, and he was on that very flight. And we had the good fortune of talking to some of his crew members, the late Lloyd Thompson and Robert Slusher, who just passed away. And they've all been able to describe these very details. So why don't we toss it to Arthur from here?
Let's bring Arthur in, Arthur Osipchuk. And Arthur, hello, sir. How are you? Good morning.
I'm fine, thank you. How about you?
Thank you. Thank you for serving, by the way. Tell us a little bit, Arthur, how old were you when all this happened?
Well, I can't remember. I went in the Army in 41, and I was about 20 then. And of course, this happened when I was 47.
Right, so about 26 years old.
Somewhere in the years.
Tell us about the flight. Tell us what was going on at the time.
Well, what happened, like you said, we was at a ski range, and then all of a sudden, Captain Ewing told us to come with him, and we had to go to the flight line, and we thought we had to make a flight test on a B-29. We put on a flight gear, and instead of a pre-flight, we was taken to the pit. We load up atomic bombs, and the plane was a B-29 straight flush.
Mm-hmm.
It was over the pit. The personnel over the pit, the MPs, kept us away and not to get near the B-29 while they were loading. And this kind of shocked us because we had top secrets. As far as you would go, we load up the bombs, and, of course, when the flight, we fused it and everything else.
Yeah, that was unusual. You were always close by that plane, weren't you?
Yes. And anyway, Then after it was all done, they had the Bombay doors closed, and then they told us we could get on board, and then we took off, and of course we went to Fort Worth. We didn't even know we was going to Fort Worth. And we stayed, of course, at low level. And, of course, then when it landed, we knew it was at Fort Worth. And to our surprise, they told us not to get off that aircraft.
What did you think, Arthur, was aboard that plane?
Well, it was shock to us because, of course, that incident happened, that flying saucers, and there was rumors there was a flying saucer and everything else happened around then. And then, of course, they said there was bodies at the hospital and the nurse passed out and they were looking for Undertaker boxes for Chow. And of course, this, we couldn't believe anything. But I can recall this. They called one time, they called us, all this incident happened. They called all the flight crews at headquarters at the meeting. They said there was no such thing as flying saucers. The ones that did, they were braggers and or they were off the rockers and we'd probably be psychoanalyzed. They told us all this stuff at the time.
So they're trying to get you all to back off anything that you might have been hearing at the time.
Yes, that's correct. But anyway, when we was coming back, I noticed it was Martucci, one of them on the crew. Exactly, I don't know who it was. He said, we made history. I don't know, it was a part of one of the crew members says, we got to keep our mouth shut. We won't talk about it anymore. We cannot even tell our wives about this. Because if we did, we'd be sent to Fort Worth for the rest of our lives. And I kept quiet about this, which was so surprising. Until after quite a few years later, I went to a convention, the 8th Air Force convention banquet, and I was at my table, and someone came in my ear, whispered my ear, and I was kind of surprised and said, Ozzy, you definitely took bodies to Fort Worth, Texas. And he took off, and I don't know who the heck he was. And how he knew this information, we're supposed to keep our mouth shut about all this information.
Absolutely. Okay, and at what point, Arthur, did you ever see what was inside the crate?
No, they wouldn't allow us in there.
Now, how big was the crate? Try to describe the size for us.
Well, what happened? They sealed everything off. They even hid the crate from us.
Okay.
We was a flight crew, and that's why we were so shocked. Why was it so top secret?
The plane back there, the cargo area for that plane, could carry something how big in terms of dimension size?
I can't remember the size of the bomb. Well, the atomic bomb was pretty good size. They had two bomb bays, and I'm pretty sure it was on the front bomb bay. They wrote on it. Atomic bomb was a pretty good size bomb, and that had to be a pretty good size box or crate, whatever it was on there. I didn't ever see it because it was roped off. They didn't even want to see us. We were so surprised and shocked. Why not?
I mean, was the bay back there, could it fit a car, for example?
An automobile?
Yeah, would that fit back there?
No, not in that Bombay. Okay. Bombay wasn't that big.
Okay, so something smaller. So maybe not a craft, but maybe there could have been possibly bodies in the box?
Yes, that's what we believe we were told by rumors, and you know how rumors fly. I just wondered how they kept the bodies from spoiling. They must have used dry ice or something. We thought all that information.
So when you landed in Fort Worth, you're told what? Stay on the plane.
Correct.
Don't get off. Somebody unloads the plane, right?
Yeah, they had a crew that unloaded, yes.
Were you able to look out the windows, or could you see anything as they were carting this box away?
No, we was in blisters, too. I don't know if the pilot or co-pilot could see, but we was in the blisters at the back. And
all right.
They had it covered up. They removed it, we didn't see nothing.
And at what point, Arthur, that after they unloaded it, did they have you fly out again?
Just soon they had unloaded it, we took off.
So they didn't even let you stay?
No. We flew off immediately.
Okay. As you fly out, you're with your crew members. How many on the plane at the time? Do you remember?
Well, we got a bombardier and a navigator, pilot, co-pilot, and an engineer, and top gun and two scanners.
So a pretty good-sized crew.
Yes.
All of you at some point had to start saying, what the heck did we carry over here, right?
Yeah, we were surprised, too. Because we did a lot of top-secret stuff. We'd go to different bases, landed at an airfield, didn't know what we was carrying, and unloaded, and then we'd fly back to another base. Then we fly back to that base, then back to Roswell. And this was, this really stumped us because we were so shocked because we brought top secret and everything else. They didn't let us nothing know on it when it was in that box. They wouldn't tell us.
Here we are now, Arthur, almost, 63 years later?
That's probably about 63. We'll be 61.
What do you think was in that crate?
Well, I have an open mind. I feel there's something that was pretty top secret. But this has been so long. Why don't they let this information out? I heard there's, I guess everybody's heard it was at Wright-Patterson. They were supposed to take the bodies up there from Fort Worth.
Right.
And put them in a deep freeze up there somewhere.
Yeah, I thought maybe the, you folks flew on to Wright-Patterson. You didn't.
So no, we didn't.
So you went back. Had this been a weather balloon, Arthur, would they have done this to you guys? Would they have kept it that secret from the crew?
Well, you know, I tell you what I thought, you know, because this is my own opinion. When they mentioned the weather balloon, you know, they said there was no such thing as flying saucers in the bodies, but we knew there was some secret in that box. And I thought they might have used it. Not mannequins, I thought they might have, for high altitude bailouts.
Yeah.
They had the B-36. I thought they might even use cadavers for experiments, but I'd imagine they used cadavers or mannequins on there for secret for bailout. We thought of that.
I had heard rumors that they might have had, the war was over, but they might have had Japanese POWs, short POWs, and that they experimented with them. Something went wrong, and they had to cover it up. Did anybody ever talk about that at all out there at that time?
No, I never heard of that. But I thought when they said weather balloon and they said high altitude, I heard the rumors they was experimenting with high altitude balloons for B-36s to bail out. Then we heard they had a weather balloon to check for radiation for when Russia was going to top that atomic bomb.
Yeah.
We thought that might be. And then, of course, there were so many rumors flying.
Arthur, what would you have done had you gone back there and they opened up the crate and you would have seen three alien bodies there from another planet?
They would have shocked me pretty good. but I remember at the time when this all happened, there was a rancher. At that time, it was rumored that he'd seen some craft crash.
Sure.
They said there was bodies underneath it. Then they shut him up after a couple of weeks.
At any point afterward, after you and your crew came back, did any more stories start filtering out what this could have been or what was going on out there?
Well, they explicitly told us, don't ever say anything, not even to our wives. They really did. And then they kind of put the brainwash, and they kind of brainwashed. You know, I never did tell my wife anything about a wife on until Tom Rhodes was writing a book, and he called up here, I can't remember, 5 or 6 years ago. And then it came on the air, and then one of my sons seen it on the History Channel.
Yeah.
That's the only time he ever opened up on it. I was surprised.
Now,
that's how long I kept secret about it.
Here you are now, in this point in your life. Do you believe that this planet was visited, maybe at least in 1947, from a craft from a different world, crashed, and we recovered it, and we recovered their bodies? Do you think that happened?
Well, I give almost 80% on that something did happen. And even you go to the historic time of the Mayas and in South America, how that stone was cut by precision instruments. No man could have cut it that much without surgical instruments to cut that rock.
It would not have surprised you, though, if they had said, Arthur, we have some alien bodies from a spaceship. You would have probably said, I figured that.
I would go along pretty good at that. It would complete my 100% belief in it.
Arthur, if you guys had flown out the bodies, possibly, what do you think might have happened to the crash craft? Where did that go?
This would have surprised me because they had to have maintenance crew. They'll pick up the debris and everything. And, of course, we heard it was in the hangar, some of the debris. But we never heard anything from the ground personnel, you know, about picking up that aircraft. But on the base, on the news media and stuff like this, they said they found a piece of metal that had glyphics on it.
Yes.
All that stuff.
Did you know anybody personally that might have picked up some pieces or anything like that?
No, I haven't. But I heard someone I heard rumors that someone did pick up some pieces on a metal. They said you could bend it and come back out and
right.
That was hard for me I'm Missouri. I'm not from Missouri, but the only Missouri you say, I believe only you can see it.
That's what they say in Missouri. No doubt about that. Did you live out that way, or you were just stationed there for a little bit?
I was stationed there for about 7 years.
Seven years. Okay. And even later on, even though you guys didn't talk about this, did you hear rumors whenever you guys went out or you go into town, that people talk about this?
No, not at that time. It was a well-kept secret.
It sure was. Sounds that way.
Yes, it was. As a matter of fact, I even thought you could get it out of my mind until I came up here for 5-6 years to Tom, and I believe it was, who was the other one?
And Don,
I guess.
Yeah.
About making that book.
Yeah. Now, the fact that government kept this a secret, how do you feel about that? That they just held back, they didn't tell you folks, they didn't tell you.
This was always bogged in my mind. Why don't they say something about it? Remember about the flying saucer, about the blue book. I'd like to add something else here. Just about 3 months ago, Italy called from Italy, and he's an author writing a book on if there's other people in outer space. And he's writing a book about it. So they believe strongly that there's people in outer space. They believe in something like flying saucers. He asked me what I knew about it.
Was he calling from the Vatican or just from a writer from Italy?
Matter of fact, he was calling from Italy. He was an interpreter for the guy that's writing this book.
Ah, okay.
And you notice also that even the Pope is trying to find out there's people in outer space.
I think so, too. He may already know, Arthur. He may already know.
And you notice here about a week ago on the news they saw an unidentified object flying in the sky was on TV.
Yeah.
Did you hear about that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So there must be something going on.
Every time you see stories like this now of UFOs and things like that, do you sit back and go, I know it's true?
I know that something has to be. It has to be.
Well, the fact that you and your crew may have flown out three extraterrestrial bodies has got to be just, that's what I call the wow factor. You got to sit back and go, we probably really did that.
I know what I do. Just, like he said, I don't know if it was a bombardier, one of them on the crew said, we made history. So they must know something more about it or not.
That's something. Arthur, how old are you now?
I'm 86.
All right, sir. My father just turned 87 2 days ago.
Well, congratulations.
And thanks for serving. Continued health to you, okay?
I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Arthur.
And thank you.
All right. That's it. Tom and Don, that's quite a story. It's quite the story from quite an individual.
And it was a story that we've heard since 1990 from another crew member on that very flight. And then a subsequent individual, and Felix Martucci, who was the bombardier who had recognized the mortician. When we found him, he wanted no part of us. He would slam the phone down. He would yell no. We even went to his apartment down in San Antonio and basically staked it out. We tried to catch him even there.
Let's talk about that nurse story that you two were telling us about before Arthur came in, who's quite a remarkable individual. I'm George Norrie. More of this incredible story, Witness to Roswell, Unmasking the Government's Biggest Cover-Up. That's next on Coast to Coast AM.